Hey, Billy, why do you look so down?
Aw, Dad, I got a computer, a PlayStation, and a barn full of iguanas, and I'm still bored.
Gee, Billy, when I was your age, I would read lots of stories in pulp magazines. Oh, with stories of weird adventure and fantasy, horror, satire, and lots of action.
Wow, that sounds great, Dad.
Yeah, I sure wish there was something like that right now.
There is, Daddy-O!
Who are you?
I'm Dr. Mary Von Rocksprocket, host of the Twisted Pulp Radio Hour. And now there's...
Yeah?
Twisted Pulp Magazine!
What's that, Doctor?
Why, it is a return to greatness! Available on all your digital devices! That is what it is! Look!
Whoa! Dad, this looks awesome!
Exciting and, dare I say it, very unwholesome!
You definitely have that right, my good man! Ha
ha! Thanks, Dr. Mary!
My pleasure, Billy! And just between you and me, I am not sure that this man is really your father. Bye!
Dad?
Just read your Twisted Pulp magazine, Billy.
Twisted Pulp magazine, available in dark alleyways behind meth labs everywhere. Or at Amazon.com or archaicmedia.info. That is archaicmedia.info. Ha 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 ha!
Perfect Art by G. Wayne Miller. Read by Frank Guglielmi. Chapter 1. Prick. That's what Cliff was. Gina had never called him that before, but now, alcohol bathing her brain, it fit. And it felt good. Really good. Whispering that word into the dying suds of this, her sixth or seventh beer. Because that's what Clifton T. James was, a prick, motivated only by what was between his legs. Men, when you got right down to it, they were all alike, weren't they? Pricks, self-centered, greedy pricks. And you, young lady? Yesterday's news? The second some new bimbo shook her tail in the bastard's face? Which is what Cliff had done. Taken up with someone new right before Thanksgiving break. A tall black-haired film major whose daddy reportedly had made a killing in real estate. The last time Gina and Cliff had talked, a desperate call she'd placed two nights ago, he mentioned how he'd asked the slut to move in with him. Gina could picture them now, high on that great weed Cliff always had, screwing like rabbits in heat. The thought sickened her. Prick! Another Bex, she told the bartender. As the evening wore on, the bar would fill with rock musicians and poets and students like Gina from the Rhode Island School of Design. But now, at 5:45 p.m., it still had its daytime colors. A lunch and after-work watering hole for lawyers and bankers and businessmen. There they were, in their ties and suits, hunched over their martinis, maybe a dozen altogether. The one closest to her was staring, undressing her with his eyes, rubbing his tongue along his teeth. Men were always coming on to her like that, even when Cliff had been with her. You would catch them doing it. Cliff used to say it was her face. What else could it be? She'd always thought her shoulders were a bit too broad, and she'd never been pleased with her small breasts, but her face was striking. She knew that much. That's what everyone told her since she'd been a little girl, that she had the perfect face. High cheekbones, like a model's, large blue eyes, blemish-free skin, deep red lips. Even drunk, like tonight. That face was radiant, but soft, like an impressionist painting. My little impressionist painting. That was Cliff's phrase. He'd coined it on their second date, a week after they met at the beginning of first semester. He was tall, handsome in a Rocky Mountain sort of way. At 27, the youngest full professor in RISD history. His field was European film, and it was there, the first day of his celebrated Bergman seminar, that they'd met. Gina, a junior, was majoring in filmmaking. Cliff was just back from sabbatical in Stockholm. The first time they made love, he seduced her with California Chardonnay and first-person accounts of the great Bergman himself.
Hello?
The voice was a woman's, sultry but polished, hinting of breeding. Gina expected a middle-aged lady wearing a mink, her fingers heavy with rings. But when she turned, she saw someone in sweatpants, high-top sneakers and sweater. Her only jewelry? A pearl necklace. She looked about 25, tall, maybe 5'9", with the homeliest face Gina had ever seen. The kind of face you felt sorry anyone had the misfortune to have. Mind if I join you? I've seen her before, Gina thought. Seen that face. It was at the RISD Museum, where Gina worked part-time. Yes, Gina remembered her quite well now. She'd come in on several occasions the last few weeks, spent most of her time in the early American galleries where Gina worked, admiring the museum's substantial American realism collection.
The way that man was staring, I thought you'd appreciate company, the woman said. Do you mind?
No, Gina said, and she meant it. Judging by the tongue action, it was only a matter of time before the accountant troll, undoubtedly married, would have been putting the moves on her.
I'm Ruth, the woman said, sitting.
I'm Gina.
Are you feeling down 'cause your lover's dumped you?
Gina's eyes widened.
How'd you know?
Oh, I can tell, Ruth said, smiling. It's a woman-to-woman thing, being able to pick up on something like that.
Gina liked the sound of that, the automatic sorority it implied.
Cliff's a prick, Ruth finished. I think that's a very accurate description of many men. Sometimes I believe that's how they think, with their cocks, which they believe to be the most marvelous little organs in the world.
Ha!
Suddenly, Gina thought she was going to cry. For 2 weeks it had been like this, from the heights of pure anger crashing down into the darkest depression. She sniffled and composed herself.
So, what do you do? She asked her new companion.
I'm an artist.
Really?
Really.
Me too. Well, sort of. I'm an art student at RISD. I'm into filmmaking.
How interesting.
What kind of art are you into?
Perfect art, said Ruth.
I guess that's what we all aspire to, Gina said, laughing.
The difference is I intend to achieve it. I'm already very, very close.
Chapter 2. In the brief period she would have to reflect on it, Gina would try to convince herself that it was only the invitation to see Ruth's paintings that propelled her out of the bar and into the woman's car. She would not admit to herself that sitting there, increasingly shit-faced, she had felt the first jolt of the sexual voltage that jumped from this stranger like electricity out of some powerful generator. She would not admit that she was attracted to her as she had been to no woman and few men. They drove through downtown Providence heading toward the waterfront discussing art. Ruth had a hypothesis. She spent years refining it, she said, and was only now painstakingly proving it. According to Ruth, only the most highly original art, the most creative,
could be pure art, and being creative, it had to be, by definition, female. Because there was no more highly creative act than giving birth, giving life for God's sake, an act exclusively female. Nothing a man could do even comes close. The mother force, Ruth said, flowed through all the best art. True artists imparted that force to their works, impregnated them with it, as it were. The result was perfect art. Art that lived and breathed with the mother force. Art not merely imitating life, but becoming life. The duty, Ruth agreed, but demonstrably true. But why, Gina saw through her drunkenness to ask, were so many of the world's great painters, sculptors, filmmakers male? Simple, Ruth said. It was a matter of oppression of women, much as what Cliff had done to Gina was oppression. Couldn't she see? Yes, Gina said. Couched in those terms, she supposed it could be true. And if circumstances had been different, alarms would have been going off in her head. But circumstances weren't different. The love of her life was gone. Her grades had plummeted. Christmas was in 2 weeks. Gina had never been lower, or this drunk.
Perfect Art, Chapter 3. Ruth's studio was in an old warehouse near the wharf. Once a beehive of activity, Providence's slow decline as a port had left the waterfront a ghost town. At this hour, 9 p.m., even the ghosts were sleeping. Gina had heard that the area was being reclaimed by artists attracted to large spaces and low rents, but tonight there was no sign of anything but rats lived here. Ruth parked and they went in through the loading dock. A freight elevator brought them to the top floor, the 5th. They walked down a shadowy corridor to Ruth's studio. Ruth slid the doors open and they went in. It was a massive place, too massive for Gina to take in all at once. She stood in the doorway, letting her eyes drift. The furnishings were sparse, only a couch and an armchair and a table or two. The floor was bare, oil-stained. Overhead, the ceiling beams were exposed. From one of them was suspended a block and tackle, a relic from the building's earlier life. The cathedral-length windows were covered with dark drapes, but it was the walls that were most striking. They were hung with an incredible array of oils, watercolors, pastels, charcoals. Most were of people, principally women, although a landscape was interspersed here and there, along with a couple of abstract pieces. It was a stunning collection, the work of someone overloaded with talent. Perfect art. The words rang through Gina's head, only now they didn't sound so hollow. Gina didn't know if Ruth had made a name for herself yet, but what she was seeing was impressive. This was talent, the kind of raw, driving talent that could take Ruth to the top. All yours? Gina asked weakly. All mine, Ruth said, her voice lacking any trace of pride. They're very good. They're brilliant. They're trash, Ruth said scornfully. Crude attempts. I think they're brilliant, Gina repeated, less confidently. That's because you're thinking too traditional, restricted and restrained. I don't blame you. Mine was once, too. Would you like some cocaine? You do cocaine, don't you? Yes, Gina managed. Then here, Ruth said, drawing two lines with a razor on a china plate. Be my guest. They got high. They sat on the couch doing lines, too many to count before long, and Ruth prattled on about perfect art, and Gina listened, trying with only marginal success to assimilate what was being said. And when everything had become a blur, a pleasant, weightless sort of blur in which Cliff no longer had substance, Ruth got off the couch and extended her hand. Come, she said. Where? The word formed on Gina's lips, but no sound came out. There, Ruth said, gesturing toward a small door. What? Gina managed.
The touch of Ruth's hands made her shiver. But it was not an unpleasant shiver. The collection. Come.
Gina did not argue.
Ruth led her to the door, turned the knob, and they went inside. It was a warm room, bright, a tenth the size of the outer studio. The walls were covered with white drapes, the floor with white shag carpeting, and there were no windows, a fact that did not strike Gina as strange until later. At one end, there was a satin-sheeted bed. At the other, an arrangement of 10 or so canvases, each mounted on an easel, each hidden under red velvet cloth, each bathed in soft ceiling lights. Another easel supported an empty canvas. Except for the bed, the room could pass for one of those chic galleries in Boston or New York. Gina wondered momentarily if she had ever done a show here. It would have been funky. It would have suited Ruth. Fit her like a glove.
I only work in here now, Ruth explained.
Comfortable? Gina said.
Yes. There was a time I could work under any conditions. Now I find comfort is absolutely necessary for concentration.
For perfect art, Gina offered. For perfect art.
Would you like to see my latest pieces?
Gina nodded.
They make what's out there look like scribbling.
I can't believe that,
but it's true.
One by one, she unveiled her works. There was a rendering of a woman's hands, the nails painted a soft pink, a woman's neck, adorned with a simple red pearl necklace, like Ruth's, a set of legs, forearms, elbows, a single shoulder, breasts, buttocks, feet, a stomach. The tiny blonde hair is barely visible.
You're not embarrassed, are you? Ruth said when she uncovered all but one of her works.
No, Gina said, and the truth was she was not embarrassed, only vaguely uneasy, and not because of the subject matter, not with the paintings per se. There was something else, something in the news a year and a half ago, something involving the police, wasn't it? She tried, but the memory couldn't be coaxed.
Something is bothering you, Ruth interrupted.
No, it's just I can't believe how good they are.
Brilliant.
They're not photographs, are they?
No.
If you look closely, you'll see the brush marks.
Bending, Gina scrutinized the paintings of the woman's legs. They were perfect legs, thin and toned at calf level, weightier, but without a trace of cellulite or varicose veins. A 16-year-old's legs. The only imperfection, if it could be called that, was a pinpoint-sized mole on the inside of the left thigh. Ruth was right. If you looked closely, you could see brush marks. Whatever else Ruth was, she thought, she was a discipline of realism.
Perfect, Gina said.
Thank you.
Is it the same person?
Not exactly, she smiled.
Nature has not blessed a single individual with such symmetry and grace, yet. But as artists, that should be our aim, should it not?
Perfection?
Yes.
Now you must see my latest. I finished it only last week.
Ruth slipped the cloth off her latest painting.
It was a female pubic region, an isosceles triangle of black hair against china white skin.
What do you think? Ruth said breathlessly, and Gina felt it again, arousal.
I think I ought to go now, Gina said.
No, you don't.
And she didn't. Not really.
Perfect Art, Chapter 4. It wasn't only the alcohol, or the cocaine, or the loneliness. There was something else that propelled Gina to share Ruth's bed. There was Gina. Since puberty, she'd wondered how it would be to have sex with another woman. Not an obsession, no. She was strongly heterosexual, and nearly all her fantasies concerned men. But there had been times seeing a woman, especially one unclothed, when she had, well,
wondered. Wasn't it Masters and Johnson who said such fantasies were normal? Wasn't it true, as Ruth implied, that the female body was intrinsically more carnal than the male's? Wasn't it all somehow tied in with its reproductive role, one far more complex than a man's, which began and ended with ejaculation? She remembered high school gym, seeing other girls naked. How amazed she had been by the diversity of the female form. No two designs precisely alike. Like snowflakes, she thought. She remembered thinking some grand cosmic scheme must be responsible. Thank God in his infinite wisdom had a reason for such diversity. She remembered accidentally brushing her friend Lori Anders when they'd been alone in the shower once, how there'd been an awkward moment of silence in which Gina's whole body tingled and her nipples were suddenly erect. How Lori's body seemed to react that way too. How there'd been a change in the air and she'd had an almost irresistible urge to caress Lori, if only for an instant. "Don't," she ordered Ruth when Ruth touched her cheek. But Ruth knew. Ruth felt it, the way Lori Anders had, the way Gina herself felt it. Building. Building. "You're so beautiful," Ruth whispered, the way Cliff once used to whisper. "No." Closer. Ruth's breath sweet. Inebrious. "Your face especially." "A perfect face," Cliff used to say. An out-of-focus image of him took shape in her mind, then was gone. "Not a blemish anywhere. Please." Her resistance was important now. Ruth moved her hand to Gina's neck, drawing them together. "A perfect face." "I must paint it." "I must make it mine." And then, no more words from either, only a dizzying avalanche of passion that carried them to bed. When Ruth had stripped, she looked at Gina, unembarrassed, as if seeking her approval. The sight of Ruth's nakedness only fueled what was raging inside Gina. It was an incredible body, with skin the color and smoothness of fine porcelain. No fat, not an imperfection anywhere, except an almost undetectable mole on her left thigh. Gina's eyes wandered, stopping as they made their way along Ruth's body. The dark triangle between her legs, her stomach, flat, firm, her breasts, shaped according to some ideal geometric formula. Her neck, slender, strong, adorned with a string of pearls. Only the face, so homely, so plain, seemed inharmonious. But the body was stunning. Gina had the crazy idea she'd seen it before. But where? Lori Anders? No. The museum? No. Ruth's paintings? Yes, that was it. Gina could see them at the other end of the room, still bathed in ceiling light. "So that's it," Gina thought, before losing herself. Now it made sense. Self-portraits. And then she was drowned in Ruth's smothering love. Perfect Art, Chapter 5. When she awoke, she was in Ruth's bed, bound, hand and foot, gagged, unable to scream. She struggled, her breath short and panicked, the pressure in her temples pumping pain through her skull. She tried lifting her arms, her legs. It was no use. "Be calm," she tried to convince herself, and after repeating it several times, she almost was. "At least you're no longer drunk." It was then, trying to pull herself together, trying to come up with something that might see her through this, that she noticed the room was different. She hadn't been moved. No, the bed was the same, the paintings were arranged in their places. But something had changed. The wall drapes had been pulled back to reveal copper plating, ceiling to floor. There were no windows. "Ruth," she tried to say,
But of course there was no sound, only movement of the sheet used to gag her. Maybe Ruth was lying in the larger studio, bound and gagged too. Perhaps she'd gone out, and while she was gone, someone had come in, found Gina, tied her, and cleaned the place out. Except nothing was missing. And Gina didn't believe any of that. Whatever was going on, Ruth had to be behind it. Probably in the other room, getting ready to... I never should have come here, Gina thought, tears forming. But it was too late for thoughts like that. She remembered a newspaper story about a millionaire's daughter who had been abducted and buried in a makeshift grave for 3 days with only a jug of water and a cardboard tube for breathing. She survived. She told her rescuers only by clinging to the faith that somehow she'd be saved. Gina tried to frame it that way. I'll be saved. Someone will report me missing and they'll come looking. But who? For the first time since last night, if in fact it was last night and not days or weeks, or only an hour ago, she thought of Cliff. He wouldn't be reporting her missing, and neither would anyone else. Not until Christmas break, at least. No one knew where she was. No one cared. It was in the middle of that new despair that Ruth came into the room. She was wearing a white robe and her head was hidden under a white hood. Gina knew it was her only when she spoke. The Mother Force was very strong last night, Ruth said. It is stronger today. Her voice was cold, distant. Gina had the inconceivable, frightening notion that there was nothing under the hood. Not that impossible, plain face of hers, only what? Emptiness? Like a blank canvas? Gina tasted bile. The copper contains it, focuses it, magnifies it. Perfect for painting. It was one of the ancients' secrets, copper. The Mesopotamians knew this medieval alchemists. A secret, alas, lost in the passage of time. Until me. Gina strained at the rope. I wish you would relax, Ruth urged. The face must never, ever be depicted as angry or scared. I must paint it, she said before kissing Gina. I must make it mine. I searched so long for you, for the final piece, Ruth said, arranging her easel at the foot of the bed. Over a year. But I do not complain. Perfect art is patient. That's when it hit Gina, hearing the word peace. That's when last night's echo of a memory sprang to life. That's when she catapulted to a new level of fright. It was a TV newscast she'd seen more than a year ago, long before Cliff had dumped her and life had shifted into surrealism. The Providence police chief had been on the screen, talking about having no new leads in the serial killer case, begging the public for help in tracking the maniac down. Gina remembered the most gruesome detail of the case, how each of the bodies had been found horribly mutilated, each missing parts, different parts in every case. The newspaper had quoted exclusive sources as saying feet, legs, hands. In one incredibly bizarre case, only the neck. Gina remembered how the victims had all been women, how the authorities theorized that the killer must have been charismatic in the most horrible tradition of the mass murderer, how he, probably had lured each of his victims with sweet talk and finesse. Put them all together. One detective had been quoted as saying in a newspaper that had been soundly criticized for publishing it. And you'd almost have a whole person, everything but a face. And another memory, this one fresher, of someone remarking that it had been over a year since the killer had struck. That someone expressing the hope that, cross fingers and knock on wood, he had tired of his gruesome game and moved along or died. That, like Jack the Ripper, had passed into history. Out of nowhere, an image formed on the fright screen of Gina's mind. An image of the Venus de Milo, which she'd pondered for hours visiting the Louvre on the summer in Paris. Such classic beauty, the statue's face and torso juxtaposed by the mutilation of time and mishandling, which had robbed Venus of her arms. Perfect art is jealous, Ruth was saying, possessive, like a lover. Ruth turned the easel so Gina could see it, an outline of Gina's face done in pencil. Roughing it out, Ruth explained. Gina's bladder let go. Ruth took a scalpel and ran it around Gina's neck along the line where she intended to decapitate her. The mother force, she said, bearing down with an inhuman strength. The source of all life and creativity. The source of perfect art.